VOA's International Edition. Coming up, HRW reports horrific treatment of Yazidis from Iraq by Islamic State.
The crimes we've documented by ISIS are, without any question, war crimes. That is very clear.
President Obama urges more robust commitments to combat Ebola. Hong Kong activists cede ground, but the protest goes on. And the apparent reappearance of the North Korean leader. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. U.S. President Barack Obama and American military commanders are due to meet today with foreign defense chiefs to discuss their coalition efforts to combat Islamic State militants in Iraq and Syria. A spokesman for General Martin Dempsey, the chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, says the talks at Andrews Air Force Base just outside Washington will cover the challenges of the operation and a vision for the way forward. Representatives from about 20 countries, including Turkey, are expected to take part. Turkish officials denied Monday that they have reached an agreement with the United States for the U.S.-led coalition to use an airbase in southern Turkey to launch attacks against Islamic State fighters. U.S. officials said Sunday discussions were ongoing, but that Turkey had cleared the use of the airbase about 100 kilometers from the Syrian border. Islamic State is holding hundreds of Yazidi children, women, and men from Iraq captive in Iraq and Syria, according to Human Rights Watch. We asked Fred Abrahams, a special advisor at HRW, about the humanitarian group's findings.
We spent about 2 weeks in northern Iraq and the Kurdish regions interviewing dozens of Yazidis who had fled from the ISIS onslaught back in August. And a number of them had been captured and then escaped. So this gave us a unique look into how people were being treated. We've got hundreds of people who are still detained, men, women, and children, some of them young children, even babies. And our report focused in particular on the treatment of women and girls. And sadly, we have documented cases of sexual assaults and forced marriages and even some cases of the sale of young women and girls.
Could you share some of those stories that you gathered?
Sure. I mean, they were horrible stories. Almost every person we interviewed said that the young women and girls were systematically separated from men. And so that, first of all, gives you a great worry about the abuse they might be subjected to. But then from the women who managed to escape, we got stories of forced marriages, including with celebrations and parties. These are fighters, ISIS fighters, who married women. And, there's really only one likely reason for having forced marriages, which is a religious veneer or justification for sexual violence or sexual assault. That's, pretty much the reason why a marriage would be necessary. And then some of the women we interviewed, and girls, I should say, under 18, teenage girls, talked about being assaulted. All of them denied being raped themselves. They all said it didn't happen. They managed to fight off their assailant. But they knew of others. They said others had told them that they had been raped. And, of course, this has to be understood in the context of Yazidi society and culture, which is conservative by nature, a great taboo to talk about sexual violence. So we don't know. I cannot say for sure that women were raped, but it certainly raises grave concerns that this is the case.
How did they escape?
Well, there are a number of ways. I mean, every individual had a different and dramatic story to tell. But the control over these people is not absolute. They're being moved around and held in different facilities in Iraq and also in Syria. Some people, including men, captured men, have managed to find their way to freedom.
What can be done about all this? It's such a mess over there with the fighting going on. Is there anything that anybody can do?
I wish there were quick and easy answers to this. I really do. I think one of the things that we're saying is, these are just the most grievous violations, and even ISIS is not trying to hide them. They're actually publicizing and boasting of these violations, admitting and using it almost as an advertisement. But to me, I think what's absolutely critical, and I really want to stress, is as nasty and horrible as ISIS is behaving, we have to pay attention to violations also by the Iraqi government and by its allied militias. As dirty and horrible as ISIS is behaving, it should not be and cannot be a green light to allow a counterinsurgency at all costs. It has to also be respectful of the law, and we have noticed serious violations by the Iraqi government and by the allied Shia militias. And there is some leverage there. You know, there isn't much leverage on ISIS. We can publish our reports, but how to influence their behavior. But there is leverage because the West and the U.S. government is supporting the Iraqi government in this counterinsurgency campaign. We hope it will help. It will push them. Western governments will push them to be more respectful of the laws of war.
Would you call these actions by ISIS crimes against humanity? And if so, could they one day be prosecuted?
Well, the crimes we've documented by ISIS are, without any question, war crimes. That is very clear, so individuals and commanders can be held to account. And all the evidence suggests, due to the scope of these crimes, that they do reach the level of crimes against humanity. And look, accountability at this point in time is difficult to imagine because the Iraqi courts, well, there's an active war, of course. Iraqi justice system leaves a lot to be desired. There's no international mechanism, but you never know. And these people should be aware on all sides in this conflict, whether ISIS or the Iraqi government side, that justice keeps moving, and one day they may well find themselves in court.
Fred Abrahams, a special advisor to Human Rights Watch, speaking with us from Berlin, Germany.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
A United Nations medical worker who contracted Ebola while working in Liberia has died at a German hospital. The St. George Hospital in Leipzig said today the 56-year-old died overnight despite intensive medical procedures. The UN mission in Liberia announced last week its staff member tested positive for Ebola on October 6th and said that none of the 41 people who have been in contact had shown any symptoms. U.S. President Barack Obama spoke with world leaders and was briefed by his public health and national security teams Monday on international and domestic efforts to confront the Ebola epidemic. VOA's Victor Beatty reports U.S. public health officials are rethinking the way they address effective Ebola infection control following the first U.S. case of the transfer of the deadly virus in Texas.
Speaking with UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon by telephone, Mr. Obama agreed on the need for more robust commitments and rapid delivery of assistance to West Africa to stop the epidemic at its source. In a separate conversation with his French counterpart, François Hollande, Mr. Obama discussed coordinated actions to contain the epidemic, including treatment facilities in West Africa and passenger screening. The president was also briefed on the response to the diagnosis of a second U.S. Ebola case, a nurse in Dallas, Texas, including the investigation into the apparent breach of infection control protocols. Media reports have identified the patient as 26-year-old Nina Pham, who cared for Liberian Thomas Eric Duncan, who died last week at Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital after arriving in the U.S. in September. She is now in isolation and said to be in stable condition. At a Monday news conference, the director of the Centers for Disease Control, Dr. Tom Frieden, said this case changes some things, but not others.
It doesn't change the fact that we know how Ebola spreads. It doesn't change the fact that it's possible to take care of Ebola safely. But it does change substantially how we approach it. We have to rethink the way we address Ebola infection control, because even a single infection is unacceptable.
Freeton says none of the 48 people who had contact or may have had contact with Duncan have developed Ebola symptoms. He says only one person may have had contact with a nurse, and that person is being monitored. The Associated Press reports about 70 staff members at Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital in Dallas were involved in the care of Duncan, including the nurse. Freeton says they are being interviewed and monitored.
If this one individual was infected, and we don't know how, within the isolation unit, then it is possible that other individuals could have been infected as well. So we consider them to potentially be at risk, and we're doing an in-depth review and investigation.
Freeton says that is the key to breaking the chain of transmission of the Ebola virus. The CDC director also says an investigation is underway into how the nurse could have become infected.
We look at what happens before people go into isolation, what happens in isolation, and what happens when they come out of isolation. And we're particularly concerned with that third process, taking off the isolation personal protective equipment, because if it is contaminated, there's the possibility that a worker will contaminate themselves and become infected in that process.
Freeton says new guidelines have been implemented, including new training of healthcare workers, the type of protective equipment they wear, and the use of disinfectants as they leave an isolation unit. He says every U.S. hospital must think about the possibility of Ebola when dealing with any patient with a fever or other Ebola-like symptoms who has traveled to Guinea, Liberia, or Sierra Leone in the previous 3 weeks. He cautions more cases of Ebola in the U.S. are possible, especially among the healthcare workers who treated Duncan. Freeton says U.S. health authorities are looking at multiple levels of protection, including the screening of people on departure flights in the three affected West African countries. All are given a questionnaire and have their temperature taken. He says nearly 80 were denied travel after displaying fever in the past 2 months, but none developed Ebola. Sunday, U.S. authorities began a similar screening process of people coming in from the three countries at New York's JFK International Airport. He says 91 were identified, none had a fever. Of those, 5 were given additional evaluation, but none were determined to have been exposed to Ebola. Similar procedures are being put in place Thursday at 4 other so-called gateway airports, including Washington's Dulles, Newark's Liberty, Chicago's O'Hare, and Atlanta's Hartsfield-Jackson. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
As Liberia tries to end its months-long Ebola crisis, local and international media rights groups report an intensification of a crackdown on journalists in the country. But journalists say this is only a continuation of Liberia's bad record on press freedom, which taints the West's positive image of President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf as Africa's first elected female head of state and the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize in 2011. Beno Muchler reports.
7 months into the worst Ebola outbreak ever, several media rights groups accused the Liberian government of preventing journalists from reporting the magnitude of the crisis. Last week, Liberia's deputy minister of information said on the radio that his government will prevent journalists from entering Ebola treatment units in order to protect the privacy of the patients. Critics see this as an attempt to hide facts about the ongoing outbreak that has killed more than 2,300 Liberians and damaged the national economy. On October 8th, the World Health Organization said the reported fall in the number of new cases in Liberia over the past 3 weeks is unlikely to be genuine and rather reflects a lack of capacity in data gathering. Liberia's Minister of Information, Louis Brown, says the allegations of government interference in Ebola news coverage are not true and adds that the government has always put an emphasis on strengthening press freedom.
Even though we are in a state of emergency, we have not permitted ourselves to slip into a situation where we were denied free speech and freedom of information. We have not and will not. We fought too hard, including the president. The president is a champion for rights and freedom. All her life, she's fought for it.
Media rights groups have a different view. Abdoulaye Camara, who is the president of the Press Union of Liberia, says the government has tried to restrict the media on several occasions during the Ebola crisis.
There's a case involving the Women Voices newspaper, and the paper actually wrote about corruption within the police in respect to Ebola-related activities. And the publisher was invited to the police station and virtually harassed.
The Committee to Protect Journalists, an international media watchdog, says another newspaper, the National Chronicle, was raided by police, citing urgent national security concerns as justification for their actions. National Chronicle publisher Philibert Brown was present during the raid.
During the interim, the police had thrown tear gas into our office, so we fled from the front of the office to the back where we had lift ventilation to breathe. In about 5 minutes after they threw the tear gas, we started hearing the bang, bang, the heavy sound of them breaking down the office door.
The incident took place after the National Chronicle had run a story about the plans of a group of Liberians to form a new government. But publisher Brown believes the closure of his newspaper came after the coverage of massive corruption cases, including the son of President Johnson Sirleaf.
It's so disappointing that a woman of that stature, you know, just you wouldn't even believe it. Every day you read the newspaper, from beginning to end, it's about corruption. She does nothing about it, all right? She does nothing to reprimand. Every time she comes out and she appoint a panel to investigate corruption, it ends with the panel.
The National Chronicle remains shut down while the case is being tried at Liberia's Supreme Court. Liberia is ranked 89th out of 180 countries in the Reporters Without Borders 2014 Press Freedom Index. Benno Müchler for VOA News, Monrovia.
China is a fascinating country
with interesting people doing amazing things.
Every Friday, we focus attention on some of our favorite things coming out of China during the previous week.
It may be political, it may be cultural.
It may simply be a curiosity that caught our attention.
But we'll find stories sure to be of interest.
And then, of course, we'll add our own American perspectives as well.
I'm Sarah Williams.
I'm Jim Stevenson.
Join us for China Focus every Friday at 12 hours Universal Time on VOA Radio.
And anytime on the web at voanews.com and on Facebook VOA Asia.
Hong Kong police used chainsaws and sledgehammers today to remove barricades from a main avenue in the financial district where protesters have camped for over 2 weeks to demand political reforms. Ivan Broadhead reports from the streets of Hong Kong that while the activists continue to protest peacefully and still hold another key thoroughfare, the rhetoric is escalating on all sides.
Pro-government factions yelled criticism at democracy protesters around Admiralty Station Tuesday afternoon, while hundreds of riot police looked on impassively. Hours earlier, the same officers, bearing shields and batons and wielding handheld electric grinders to cut through metal, pushed back students and tore down barriers that for 2 weeks had blocked the Queensway Highway. While the demonstrators withdrew peacefully to other strongholds in the area, they criticised the police action in light of their offer to withdraw from the streets entirely if the government would allow their relocation to Civic Square, the public plaza outside the Hong Kong legislature. Alex Chow, head of the Hong Kong Federation of Students, says that move has been repeatedly rejected, so the activists will remain on the streets.
As long as the constitutional issue could not be settled and persuasive answer could not be given to those protesters, the movement will be ongoing. Whether we could gain enough bargaining power with the government, it depends on the number of people supporting the movement. They might not come out for a particular occupied area, but as long as the government keeps silence on the current situation, then they will come out again.
The police action to reopen Queensway comes as pro-Beijing civic groups increase pressure on the government to deal more stringently with a democracy movement that has paralysed Hong Kong for 17 days. At City Hall, around 200 members of the Chu Chow Association, comprising Hong Kongers with ancestral links to this southern Chinese city, marched on student barricades and urged the democracy activists to vacate the streets. District Councillor Stephen Chan Chit Kwai, leading the march, says the protesters continue to prevent shops from opening, students getting to school and patients to hospitals.
Thank you for their, you know, good wishes, you know, to do something to improve the community. We thank you for that, but we would advise them, you know, already more than 2 weeks, it's time for them to go home and to clear the way for the public.
Wednesday will see the Hong Kong legislature resume its first post-summer meeting. Security around the legislative complex is expected to increase overnight as legislators return. While there is only one certain topic of discussion in the chamber, uncertainty remains about whether Hong Kong leader Lian Chengying will even attend. Ivan Broadhead for VOA News, Hong Kong.
The mysterious absence of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un from the public eye appeared to end today with pictures on state-run media showing Mr. Kim smiling and gesturing while on an inspection tour of a new housing complex in Pyongyang, as well as a science institute. There was no explanation for his nearly six-week absence or the date when the photos were taken. Speculation swirled about the extended absence, ranging from health problems to a need for rest to a leadership coup. However, that is not how Tufts University Korean Studies Associate Professor Sung Yong Lee sees it. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty Mr. Kim's return to the limelight was preordained.
If this were a first, Kim's extended vanishing act from the public view, then there would be some reason, some credence in those views that there might have been a coup d'etat or Kim may have been arrested or been deposed. But there are plenty of precedents for this kind of disappearing act by Kim Jong-un, by his father, who disappeared for almost 3 months in 1994. So this is symptomatic of our misreading of North Korea. North Korea is very different. If a leader in a democracy had disappeared for 40 days, that would raise eyebrows. That would be most unusual. But in a totalitarian system like North Korea, Kim is the state. He is the king. He is totally free to come and go as he pleases. So we often end up misreading North Korea, whether it's on prospects for denuclearization or economic reform. And as a result, we end up paying the price.
This is a relatively young man, believed to be in his early 30s, but he is helped in his walking with a walking stick. Do you see any significance there?
Perhaps he's had an ailment in his knees or ankles, I don't know. But it would not be a liability for North Korea to show their top leader carrying a walking stick, because in North Korea, that would send the message that the leader, despite his physical discomfort, is working very hard around the clock to raise the living standards of the people. It's in the Confucian mold, traditional Korean mold, of portraying the leader as working very hard, dedicated to the common cause of the common man.
We understand, of course, that the Kim family has engaged in such absent behavior before, but the question is, why do they leave for an extended period? Some analysts I've spoken with suggest it's just a way to grab world attention, which is focused elsewhere.
I would agree with that assessment. North Korea has a tendency to grab the world's attention, whether by provocations like a missile or nuclear test, or pulling a stunt like this. So North Korea is able to grab our attention, get bigger powers like the United States, South Korea, Japan, and China, and so forth, back to the negotiating table. And North Korea is very deft in playing this game. And as a result, we've been paying the price for the past 20 years on nuclear diplomacy. North Korea has reaped tens of billions of dollars from the world's biggest countries for repeated false pledges of denuclearization. So I would say we should take North Korea very seriously and not trivialize or infantilize North Korea.
This all comes at the time when the United States is trying to meet with North Korea to, in large part, gain the release of at least three Americans being held inside North Korea. North Korea seems to be holding the U.S. at arm's length. Why?
Well, because North Korea, again, is playing the carrot and stick game, and North Korea wants to raise the stakes for the United States. Winning the release of the three U.S. citizens detained in North Korea is a priority, although it may not be the top priority. But North Korea is dangling that phantom carrot in front of Americans, saying, well, if you come back to the table and talk to us and offer us more money and other blandishments, maybe you can get what you want. And North Korea has been sending that signal for months now.
Last month, the United States proposed consultations with the North on sending a special UN envoy to Pyongyang to try to secure the release of detained Americans Kenneth Bay, Matthew Todd Miller, and Jeffrey Fowl. U.S. North Korean human rights envoy Ambassador Robert Qing has twice been refused entry into the country to discuss the matter.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On October 14th, 1066, the Norman forces of William the Conqueror at the Battle of Hastings defeated English King Harold II and his army. Harold was killed and William claimed the throne of England, ending Anglo-Saxon rule and beginning an era of greater English involvement in continental Europe. In 1322, Robert the Bruce of Scotland defeated King Edward II of England at Byland, forcing Edward to accept Scotland's independence. On this date in 1644, William Penn, founder of the British North American colony of Pennsylvania, or Penn's Woods, was born. On this date in 1947, Air Force test pilot Captain Chuck Yeager flew the experimental Bell X-1 rocket aircraft, breaking the sound barrier for the first time. On October 14, 1962, an American U-2 spy plane took pictures proving that Soviet-made medium-range missiles capable of carrying nuclear warheads were stationed on Cuba. The revelation brought the United States and the Soviet Union to the brink of nuclear war in what is called the Cuban Missile Crisis. In 1964, American black civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for his nonviolent resistance to racial segregation in the United States. At the age of 35, King was the youngest person ever to receive the award. And on October 14, 2012, Felix Baumgartner jumped from the stratosphere, breaking the record of the highest free fall jump at an altitude of more than 39,000 meters. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This fall marks the 25th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. We live in a better world, said U.S. Secretary of State for European and Eurasian Affairs Victoria Nuland, because the countries of Central Europe chose the path of a Europe whole, free, and at peace. But today, she warned, that choice is under threat, and Central Europe is once again on the front line in the fight to protect our security and our values. One of those threats is Russia's aggression in Ukraine. Most of Central Europe has responded with generous offers of assistance, security support, and even as Slovakia, Hungary, and Poland have done, reversed the flow of gas to help fill Ukraine's winter storage tanks. Most Central European countries have also been strong advocates for the sanctions placed on Russia. Ukraine is working hard to promote peace and change. It is fulfilling its commitment under the September 5th Minsk Agreement. It passed amnesty legislation and a special status law for the East, scheduled early local elections for December 7th, and is working with Russia to demarcate the special status zone. Now Russia and its proxies must do their part. Withdraw their forces and all the heavy weapons that have flooded the East, restore Ukrainian sovereignty, and withdraw heavy weapons on the international border. Allow robust OSCE monitoring of both sides of the border and return all of the hostages, notably Nadia Savchenko and Oleg Sentsov. Another threat to the region is ISIL, or the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. That's why nations of Central Europe are joining the global coalition to degrade and destroy ISIL's acts of terrorism, contributing to ammunition reserves, training, and humanitarian assistance. But more needs to be done to prevent ISIL recruitment and financing in the transatlantic region. While defending certain values abroad, the countries of Central Europe must be vigilant in preserving democratic values such as press freedom, civil society, and rule of law at home. As President Obama has said, the blessings of liberty must be earned and renewed by every generation, including our own. Echoing President Obama, Assistant Secretary Nuland commented that we must renew our commitment to our citizens and each other. We are stronger together, and many around the world who crave the same freedom we enjoy are depending on us.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.